Oh, yeah.
Thank you.
Right on.
This mic picks up really well, so you just talk wherever.
Okie dokie. My name is Barbara. I'm an alcoholic. I am so grateful to be here, grateful to see people outside of a medical setting. My sobriety date is May 25th of 2001. My home group is the Midtown Group. I have a sponsor, and she knows that she is my sponsor, and I actually talked to her yesterday, which is great. And I sponsor women in Alcoholics Anonymous and make every effort to say yes and commit myself to service to other people as best I can. So I'm going to tell you in a general way what I used to be like and what happened to me and what I am like now. I grew up in Northern Virginia, native Washingtonian, if you will. My parents met at a party in Washington, D.C. It was actually robbed, and I guess they bonded over that, and then, you know, stayed together. And I grew up and lived in that area most of my life, including now. Made my way all the way over to Maryland, but that's it. And so I was raised in a home that was very social. My parents had lots of parties. We have a big family on my mom's side, very connected to them, and grew up around a lot of drinking. And both of my parents, so there are four people who grew up in my house, me and my brother and my parents, all ended up in AA at one point or another. My brother is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous with, it's got to be close to 30 years at this point. My mom has over 30 years of sobriety. My dad was sober at one point and is now actively dying of alcoholism, doing his best for the last 6 years or so. The stark contrast between the availability of my mom and my brother, knowing where they are, who they are, where I can find them at any given moment, their health, and in comparison to my dad, who can't even manage to answer his own phone, let alone keep a cell phone on, because he can't pay the bill, you know, because we know where our money goes. So the contrast is not lost on me as an alcoholic. So best if I, you know, for me as an alcoholic to stick with this thing, stay in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous and never lose sight no matter what comes into my life, no matter how important I think I am or how important I think something outside of me is, never to lose sight that my primary problem is alcoholism, my alcoholism, and it'll define my life either with recovery or it'll define my life with drinking. And those were really kind of the only two choices that I have. So that's my experience anyway. What have I done with my coffee? Okay. So I grew up, alcohol was around, very plentiful. I know from friends from other fellowships that does not make me an alcoholic, because you can grow up around a lot of alcohol and not become an alcoholic. But for me, I saw that my parents were, they seemed to me, my experience, that they were pissed off and bitter and didn't get along when they were hungover, and they were really happy and a lot of fun when they'd been drinking. Like when they'd been drinking, they let me do things like get a dog, and then when they'd sober up, I'd have to give the dog away. You know what I mean? So it's a clear message on which was, you know, more fun. And so I was eager to try alcohol for myself, and I did. I took my first drink by myself in the wet bar in my house, which was an entire room. And the room had a full wall that was a mirror, very 1970s. Mm. And mirrors behind the bar, which was glass shelving with a teak bar, and the lights were, it was the nicest room in our house. The lights would come up under the booze and light it all up. It was lovely. And so I went in there, and there was a little fridge. I went in there and poured myself what I could reach. And I remember what it is. It doesn't really matter, but I remember that burning feeling when it went down, and as it was going down, thinking, why would you want to drink something that tastes like this? And then as it started to fill up my whole spirit, I got it. And I got it right from the beginning. I didn't realize, I realized I was an unhappy kid, which is like, you know, that's just where I was at from the beginning. But I didn't realize how unhappy I was and how happy I could be until I took that drink. I remember that, I think it was about 8 or 9 years old. And I just remember that so distinctly. I remember the burning and thinking, what? And then the revelation, if you will. It was really like an enlightenment. And I don't use that lightly. For me, it really was. And I chased that feeling so hard. And many times I could capture it. You know, I could drink pretty much anything and experience some relief. But darn if I didn't just have all kinds of consequences pretty much every time I drank right away. I already wasn't quite fit for the world emotionally. And adding alcohol to me very briefly, maybe for about 3 or 4 months, made me a little bit more manageable because I was a little bit more comfortable. But then it all just fell apart. I mean, I was one of those kids, I was walking down the street, you would think, and you had children, that kid is doing drugs or drinking, and I wouldn't want my kid with a, you know, hanging out with that kid. And that, I mean, it just was everything to me. I wanted it to be my whole way of life, and I just embraced it and made myself out to be as cool as I thought I could be, and you know, with a rough crowd, and I like to be around angry things, angry music, angry people, because I was full of fear, and anger just seemed so much cooler than fear. Like, I felt like my mom was full of fear and depression. It's just disgusting to me. Like, why? And I trained myself to be very angry, which has come back to bite me pretty hard in the last 10 years or so. But for some reason, I thought being angry was so much better. Which is interesting, because when I'm around angry situations or angry people now, it makes me incredibly uncomfortable. I'm totally comfortable with my anger while it's happening. A few minutes later, I'm not comfortable, which is a sign of recovery for me. But for me, the drinking fueled the anger and the rage and fueled the... And then it began to really fuel the depression, too. I just became one of those people I couldn't take a shower for weeks on end, change my clothes. Not because I was like out on the street. I couldn't get it together to do that. So, so internally isolated and withdrawn. I went to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. So like I said, I was very unmanageable from the beginning. I was almost always getting kicked out of school and in trouble, and you know, if someone, you know, if the police came and they were going to catch somebody, it was going to be me, because I was, you know, probably passed out, something written all over my face by like 9 o'clock. So everybody else scatter, and I'd be the one caught. I was always the one caught. If we were doing something we shouldn't be doing at school, I'd be the one that they caught. So I went to my first AA meeting when I was 15 years old. I went to a club. No, it was at a YMCA near my house in Arlington, Virginia, where I grew up. And it was very dark. And I was there because I was in a lot of trouble. And it was the 80s. And people were saying, if you have alcoholism, then all the problems that you have, well, this is what I heard, all the problems you have aren't your fault. Just because you're an alcoholic and it's a disease. And so everyone should forgive you and be water under the bridge. And then you can hang out with these young people in AA and they're cool too and be fine. And that didn't quite work out for me. I spent the next, let's see, from 1988 until 2001, mostly sober, but not really in recovery, if that makes sense. So not drinking, not doing drugs with, you know, the occasional relapse where I just was so full of alcoholism, completely dry sober, that I just couldn't take it and had to drink, you know. And so I just did that on repetition, you know. And I heard all the right speakers, and I had lots of sponsors, many of whom stayed continuously sober. And so it wasn't the, you know, I was going to bad meetings where they weren't like doing the steps. It just, well, maybe some of them, but it's not that I wasn't around recovery. Not that that doesn't work for some people, but for me, just going to meetings and hanging out in the fellowship I know that it does seem to work for some people. It just didn't work for me. I needed complete rearrangement. You know, when I was first coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, they had a saying, the same person will drink again. And that, I mean, sign of the times, they say the same man will drink again, but you, same person will drink again. And that has rung so true for me. It was really my story for all those years, you know. I'm grateful that I was exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did the same thing. The one thing I did do really right is that I won't say I kept coming back because I don't think I have power over that. I think that's by the grace of God. But I will say that I threw myself into it the way I threw myself into drinking. Like I put on a drinking costume, became a drinking person. And I did the same thing where I tried to hang out in Alcoholics Anonymous. I tried to just immerse myself. I went to all the young people's conferences and went to lots of meetings, and I had a regular set of meetings I would get to. And I hung out with a certain group of people, and I wanted them to like me. And so some of my defects of character, where I want to be a follower and not take responsibility for my life, that actually really helped me. And I spent more time not drinking than drinking. But every once in a while, I would get too resentful or too angry. And that as I started to go out in the world and not just be around AA people 24/7, I would be around alcohol. I would pick up a drink. I mean, like nearly every time I was around it or exposed to or had the opportunity, I'd either almost drink or drink. And he talks about that in our literature, that, you know, you could have the idea that you'll send your alcoholic relative off to, you know, some island in the middle of nowhere, like in Antarctica or wherever it's at. I'm misquoting it, but you're out in the middle of nowhere and they will find somebody that has booze. And this is exactly how it is for me. I can't just remove myself from the situation. That doesn't treat alcoholism. Alcoholism for me is, as it describes in the literature, it happens not just physically and my surroundings and my environment, but it's also in my mind, it's in my spirit big time. And for me, my emotional security is very wrapped up in alcoholism. And so I kept relapsing, you know. And when I would, it would just be one thing or another. Either I would just, you know, take one thing and then, or drink one thing and feel so in my head and hear all the AA talk and just come running back and be like completely terrified. And I never, every time I would start to have mental compulsions and actively plan to drink, that wouldn't be the time I would drink. It'd be the time where it seemed to sneak up on me out of the window and just come in. I started to think I was crazy, you know, like not just an alcoholic, but like completely delusional, which was what it says in here that alcoholism is. But I wasn't really in the book, as I said. So I didn't know that was a part of alcoholism where it talks about strange mental blank spots. I mean, that is the story of those years for me. I would tell myself, oh, this drug isn't alcohol at all. It's not even addictive. And then I would take it, you know, and there's no drugs like that, by the way. I mean, like, there's antibiotics and things like that, but there's no drugs like that are selling on the street corner like that. Those are all for me as an alcoholic, alcohol in different forms, you know, and they were trying to treat the same thing. And so I had a series of things, events like that. You know, one story was I was with a bunch of people in the program and we were going to go camp out for concert tickets. And we were at RFK. It's a long time ago. And we were all together. And next thing I know, I saw somebody from high school and I was over there and I was, you know, just picked up a drink and doing some other things. And just like that. And even, I had just come from a meeting and shared about how grateful I was. And I meant it when I was there, you know. But I need, so I have alcoholism 100%. So I need, just like, you know, I have no thyroid. So I have 100% hypothyroidism. And they took it out. I have zero thyroid. I have to take the thyroid medicine every day, right? Because I don't have a thyroid. So it's the same thing with my alcoholism. Like I have 100%. Like It's not like I have it when I'm at the meeting and then I can go home and be a crazy person in my house and expect to stay sober. I mean, now, like I said, it would work for a period of time and then it would stop working. And so the treatment for my alcoholism, which is practicing these steps, working these steps with a sponsor who knows what's going on with me on a regular basis and staying current with that, with a fellowship, particularly for me, of women around me that know where I'm at and what I'm actually doing, really. And God, I need a higher power, as it's outlined in the book. You know, it says, you know, these are personal stories of our personal adventures of coming and knowing a higher power. You know, for me, that's the what happened. I kind of got sober, strangely enough, on the eighth and the ninth step. I got to a place where I realized I've been hanging out in AA all those years, 1988 to 2001. I hadn't made amends to anybody in my family. And I hadn't even ever written an eighth step. And the sixth and seventh step were something that you read in the 12 and 12, and you learned some things to say when you shared at a meeting that sounded like something you heard your sponsor say. That was as far as I'd gone the steps. The fourth step was something where I listed all those people that hurt me and felt ashamed of a bunch of mistakes I made, and then didn't change. And the second step was, and third step were me begging God every time I felt like I was in emotional pain to fix it, you know? And then being powerless was like removing myself from alcohol. So that's not actually what's in here. Thank God, because if it was, that would be how it doesn't work. And so for me, I got sober because I was around a group of people that were really, so I was in Southern California at my brother's home group, Bellflower Big Book Group in Bellflower, California. And I was sitting in a meeting week after week where people were speaking from the podium that had worked the 12 steps in their life. And I knew that I hadn't. And as each week went by, I realized I hadn't worked the eighth and the ninth step. And then I realized I hadn't really done the sixth or seventh step. And then I went on this big book study with the group because, so the reason why I was there is I got into graduate school because someone told me to apply to this school in Philadelphia. I had never heard of, and I applied and I got in. And I BS'd my way through the interview because they were like, what do you think about this, about our program? I was like, oh, I think it's great. I had no idea what they were talking about. I didn't realize they were going to send me all over the country my second year of the program. So that's how I ended up in California. And I happened to be, for the, you know, people listening on the tape, I'm air quoting, I happened to be at this meeting every week. And then I happened to be at this conference because one of the home group members was also named Barbara. And she couldn't attend, and she remembered that my name was Barbara, and she said, here's a free slot, because as a graduate student, I wouldn't have been able to afford it. So I happened to be at this weekend, in air quotes, because God put me there, because I was sitting there, and I was listening to them talk, and I realized not only had I not done the sixth and seventh step, I had not done the second or third step, and that I was lying about my sobriety date, and that I was in real trouble. So I came home. I took an inventory. I talked to the sponsor I had at the time. And then I just got really busy in school. And then my sponsor died. And I just kind of pushed it down. I still didn't change my sobriety date. And I was sponsoring a bunch of people in the middle and just angry. You talk to my husband and hear him tell that part of my story. I was angry and rageful. I could act one way at the meeting. I was horrible. I can't believe in the middle of all this, he married me. So, you know, we'd gotten married. I got everything I wanted. And then I finally got pregnant. My sponsor died in the middle of all this. I was kind of using a sponsor for a few months, and then I would get another one. And then I got a third one. I had all these secrets I couldn't tell her. I wrote her a letter with all the secrets, including thinking that I should change my sobriety date. At this point, I've celebrated like 20 years. you know, which wasn't correct. And I wasn't, you know, I will say, for anybody in the room that may be this way, I wasn't trying to lie to you. I was lying to myself, and I didn't know it, which is, a really important part of this. This is why we have to stick together. This is why we need each other, because hearing your stories and hearing people tell their story of recovery at those meetings disturbed my alcoholism so much that I had to get honest. You know, it took a long time because that was a painful thing to admit. I mean, here I was in my home group. There was only one other person who had more sobriety than me that was female. And I sponsored like 18 people. For me to come out and be like, actually, you know, I took these drugs, you know, 11 years ago, and I really should change my sobriety date was like, and I found people in the program that would be on my side, you know, and those are the people that I talked to. And I'm not saying that they were wrong. There are times where, like, you know, please, if you get your appendix out, I mean, talk to your sponsor, but, like, you know, I don't know if, like, Tylenol is just going to be it for you. But for me, I got to those places with rage and resentment where I had so much anxiety and rage and then, would have a prescription for a medical reason, but I took it for emotional relief. I took it to relieve my alcoholism, you know, and that's something where when they say on that chip and in our literature, to thine own self be true, only we can answer that for ourselves. And I'm going to come back to that because I think it's so important. But so finally, I got the yellow house with a white picket fence and the husband and the baby. And I was crazy. And I was on my way to a medical conference in Atlantic City, just like Dr. Bob. Not a proctologist, though. But just on my way. And I knew I was going to drink there because I was so full of self-doubt and dishonesty and resentment and rage. And I can't work the rest of the steps until I've done the first step. I just can't, you know? And so I got a new relationship with my higher power that weekend. And I began to ask for help. It took me one more year, maybe two more years, to actually change my sobriety date. I did a lot of praying about it. It was very difficult. Now I look back and I'm like, oh my God, why didn't I just do it, you know, when it happened? Why didn't I just do it when I was at that conference in California, like, what was that, 4 or 5 years before? That's like saying, why didn't I get sober when I was 18? I mean, who the hell knows why we do what we do? I guess I now, because I'm sober and I'm at peace and I'm in recovery and recovered from the obsession to drink, I believe that that happened so I can have that message because somebody needs to hear it. I don't know who you are, but you're welcome. then, like anybody who's relapsed, I had the message in my head telling me constantly, once I changed my sobriety date, I got a new sponsor who supported that decision, who incidentally was from that same group out in California, but happened to be living here now, more air quotes. God works in mysterious ways. So I changed my sobriety date, and then my brain started telling me I should leave my home group and go somewhere else and just pretend like that didn't happen, and that I had my old sobriety date so I could still be, you know, Queen Bee, which is one of my nicknames, I should just go out and really drink because I don't have a real story and no one wants to hear this story in Alcoholics Anonymous. And why is my story so weird? And why couldn't I just like drink and then get sober when I got to AA like a normal person? I mean, just craziness. You know what I mean? Because what does that mean? For each of us, there is a different story. So all that alcoholism, and that's so common. I'd relapsed many times. And so part of me had the experience of knowing that when you come back, your brain will try to drag you back out the door. And that's alcoholism. That mental part of alcoholism will tell you constantly, you should be ashamed of yourself. You shouldn't talk to anybody. No one wants you here. You don't belong here. It is that until those voices stop, it is so important for us to stay close to those people if they are asking for help. if they're not asking for help, then we're just bothering them. But those voices are very powerful. And so I just had a different brand of those voices. And then finally, after a period of time, as it will, if you know you keep coming back and you are honest with other people and with yourself, that passed, you know. And finally, I don't know when it was. I settled into who I am with the sobriety date I have today, my honest, true, thank God, sobriety date of May 25th, 2001. And there were, going back to that, what I said I was going to go back to, there were people who told me that was stupid. I shouldn't have changed my sobriety date. I don't believe in, like, as an AA member, I'm not big on, like, setting up boundaries or, like, cutting people out of my life or not talking to those people or not going to that meeting. I think I need to be everywhere and be helpful to everybody. For a time, I couldn't listen to those people. I wasn't going to call those people. So before, I would have called that person on the phone and either try to convince them because of my own stuff, but which is like some people call people pleasing. I call it pride because that's what it is. Just different version. And it's none of my business what anybody thinks about me. I have to be true to myself. And I will tell you, people that know me better than I know myself, and there are many, from the moment I made that decision and got that new sponsor and began to work the steps from the beginning again and start my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've really had a spiritual experience. I am not the same person that I was. I can give you 100 witnesses on that. Thank God. I still can get angry in ways you wouldn't believe looking at me at this moment. Believe me, I can get really angry. And I still have that in me. That's really hard. That training that I did, worked really hard on as a teenager, has been hard to let go of. And did not really bother me until I had children, because I don't want to scare my children or harm them in any way. And children, if you live with them, they're really like the antithesis of self-centeredness. And I am still self-centered. So it's very difficult to be around. It's hard to live with anybody, but especially little self-centered people. You know, I mean, God bless them. But they're, you know, they need things, you know, like food and shelter, my money, you know. And right now, homeschooling. Yeah, I'm taking a deep breath one day at a time this week. But so that's been difficult for me. But my children know that I get angry. They sure do. But they know that I say sorry. And they know that I'm a safe person. I'm not going to physically hurt them, you know. I might hurt their feelings, but I will apologize. And, you know, the house I grew up in, nobody was ever wrong except for me and my brother. You know what I mean? Whether they were wrong or not was irrelevant. So, you know, that's good. I don't know if I'll ever not, I don't know if I'll ever walk into a room where somebody spilled milk and be happy and cheerfully there. But not that I care about spilled milk as an example. But I do know how to apologize. And I know how to use the 10th step with my family and bring recovery into those relationships, which has been such a powerful thing, especially these last couple months. So that's my what happened. That's how I got to the first step and began me on a journey with my sponsor that I had for several years. She became more and more physically unavailable, sponsoring a lot more people. And with my dad getting sick and everything, I needed someone that I could call, you know, constantly. And I had a backup person I was calling, and ultimately I switched over to the backup person. It was my sponsor today, Joni, who's been my friend since, I don't know, she was 17 and I was 18 or something like that. So she's known me a long time. I saw her get sober and she stayed sober. And so that's been a great experience. And, you know, the amount of pride that I came in here with when I finally hit bottom, when I say came in here, I mean like when I finally got sober in 2001, the amount of pride that I had nurtured over the years that one minute would tell me that I was the worst piece of crap in the world, the next minute would tell me that no one should be telling me what to do. It maybe within the same second, not even a minute. Kept me so isolated, and I never, ever at that moment would have been able to ask Joni to be my sponsor, because she's younger than me, and I saw her get sober, and I've grown into a person that it's not about the personality, it's about the principles. And she is a woman who works this program in her work life and her family life, and I see it, and I've seen it for years, and I want what she has, and she is definitely ahead of me in this game called practicing these principles in all our affairs. Once I did the first step and stopped having the back door of being able to pick up, you know, whatever prescription or alcohol or Corona, meaning the drink, or whatever, having that back door of like, if it gets too hard, I'll just drink. Once that door began to close and I really committed myself to throwing myself in this program, things really began to change. When I was younger, I did have more of a, when I was first on the program, I did have more of a sense of like an emotional connection to a higher power that I really haven't come back to. Maybe one day I will. But for me, God is more of a, I have to intellectually remind myself that I'm not doing this alone. I have to have a lot of reminders. Like I need apps on my phone, not to remind me to pray. I have to have a schedule. Like I wake up in the morning go to bed in the morning sometimes because I work at night. I wake up in the afternoon, so morning in air quotes, and I have a box with meditation books and a journal, and I take the 10th and 11th step, and I take time to do that. And if my kids are all up in my grill, I find a quiet place or I wait till they've gone to school. So this week will be interesting. I'll be doing like 10 and 11 every night instead of in the morning or at work or in the car. Whatever you got to do. But I need that time to reset, because I'll forget and I'll think, you know, I have that training from my childhood and my teenage years and living out there roughing it with alcoholics that it's me against the world, you know, and I can't afford to live like that as an alcoholic. So I need to have training. I need to have reminders. I need to have kind of a schedule for me. There are many times in my life where today, and this is one of the promises, have really come true, even as I just was approaching the 8th and 9th step, that I will look at, I'll feel a breeze on my face, or I'll look out and see a view, or I'll hear a song, or I'll be at a Broadway show, or I'll be with one of my kids playing a game, and it'll hit me. That consciousness of God's love for me, you know, and I feel like I had a little bit more of that in my heart when I was younger, but when I do get it now, it is very precious, you know, and so it's a little bit different, but that's kind of where I've been with that. For me, I say the third step prayer every day. It's part of my little ritual. Do I say it in my heart? No, but usually those days, some point in the day, I'm like, oh God, I forgot to really say that, you know? So the world will remind me if I forget, that I am prone to be in the bondage of self, you know, and that I need to ask God's help to get out of it, and to be able to do the next right thing, which to me is really what the essence of the third step is about, is making the decision to do the next right thing and practice these principles in my life. Doing the fourth step after having really taken the first step is a completely different experience, because I was a little bit less interested in what they had done. As a matter of fact, I felt an aversion to looking at what they had done. Which was really interesting. It's like I didn't want to see it. That's all I wanted to talk about when I was drunk. Like, you wouldn't believe what my parents, you know. I would see it and just want to move on, you know, because I don't want to be in sickness anymore. And I don't want to carry around what happened in 1976 or 1984 into every freaking conversation I have, you know, or every time a man talks to me that I'm not hearing my dad. You know, like until I could uncover certain things that had happened and my part in them, my mistakes in these relationships, could I move on and be where I am now? You know, when I'm in a situation with my boss, I mean, I'm still sick. Every time my boss calls me, I have two male bosses. Every time they call me, I think I've done something wrong. I haven't done anything wrong in the 12 years I've been there. They've never called me because I've done something wrong. They've either called me to give me a compliment or asked me to do more. So, one of these days, hopefully I'm not meant to get that well, but the fourth step and those resentments, they really colored every relationship. I carried everything with me that ever happened. And I didn't even realize it. It was just like when I took that first drink and I didn't realize how unhappy I was before until I started shining the light on some of these things. I didn't realize how much I was carrying misinformation and my so-called injustices of things that happened to me or things I was ashamed about that I had done into, you know, how I was a parent, how I was a wife. And it really left me with the sense of like having no idea what I'm doing as a parent, as an employee, this real sense of unease, which is a great place to land for 6 and 7 for me. A whole lot of willingness in beginning at I have no idea what I'm doing. And so, it worked, the 6 and the 7 step, in a way that was outlined with the sponsor I had at that time, and something that I worked for her. And really, I make it a part of my 10 step every day to have the list of character defects, and as I see them, see a list of opposites. Not that I'm going to make myself act the opposite way, but that as I prayed that 6 and 7 step prayers, ask for willingness and ask for God's help changing, that I know that those are things I also carry with me. You know, where I have anger, I also have, in the same heart, I can have gratitude. And I can, you know, aspire to be more grateful. And so, not that, you know, I'm so powerful and I'm going to make myself be changed, but I'm not all bad, you know, and I'm not all good. Both of those things are possible. And the idea that, you know, well, I'm just broken and so I'm just going to act this way, that really had to go, you know. I have to. I can't ask God just to get me a parking spot. I have to get in the car, drive to the parking lot and look for myself, you know. I really want to talk about the 8th and 9th step because this has recently been very powerful for me. I definitely drank in a way, as I said, that I was obviously disturbed. I was disturbed anyway, and then I drank, and I was obviously a disturbed drunk. And I had streets I couldn't go on. I had all those things, you know, people I was embarrassed to see. People that had known me before I came to AA the first time, as young as I was, I had definitely had people I never wanted to see. And if I saw them, I would duck away. And I don't have anything like that anymore. Those things have all been cleared up. And where I couldn't find the people, because some of this was before social media, and some people my age don't do that, social media. So one time I got on an elevator to get a paycheck from a temp agency I was working for when I was a medical assistant. And this girl got on that I grew up down the street with, and I owed her an amends, and I could not believe it. And I was so shocked, I didn't say anything. And then the opportunity was gone. And the next time I went to go get my paycheck, she was there again, you know, like on a completely random different day. So if I work 8 and 9 and I meant to make these amends for the good of my own sobriety and for probably the good of the world and the community, then these opportunities will present themselves in my experience. More importantly, I've been able to make amends with my family. I'm very grateful that I was able to make amends with my father before. And I will say there are some relationships where it's not, there's not going to be peace and kumbaya and all that stuff. I mean, he is a very sick alcoholic, and for the most part, it's definitely not safe for my kids to be around him. But for the most part, it's not a great idea for me to be around him, or sometimes even talk to him. And it's something I pray about each day. And I did, you know, go visit him a couple. He's down in Florida, and is too sick to travel anymore. Plus, I think there are warrants up here. So, but I did go down to visit him a few times, and I'm grateful that I had the chance to do that, because for me, it crystallized that there was nothing more there. I needed to see him face to face to be sure of that. Because I have an illness that centers in my mind, and I will tell myself everything's fine when it's not. I mean, I still do that. My husband will be so mad at me. I'm like, why are you mad? He's been, I've been mad for a week, and I haven't noticed, you know. If you don't tell me, I'm, you know, because I want everything to be fine all the time. So I'll just believe it, you know, and act how I want. So this is a long way to go, but I still have some more amends to make, and looking forward to probably taking a trip over the summer for that. Because as I sponsor people and work with people, more is revealed. Like, I did that 8th and 9th step list, but as I continue to work with people and hear things, or sometimes things will just come to me. I'll, you know, be working on something completely random, and it'll just come to me like, oh, my God, I never approached that person about that, you know. And so I'm looking forward to hopefully being able, you know, God willing, with everything going on, I'll be willing to do that, make that trip. Yeah, I kind of already told you about 10, 11, and 12. So for me, I work shift work. And so I haven't been able for the last 3 years to commit to up where I live. The AA commitments are 6 months at a time, or a year, or 2 years at a time. And I can't commit to being at the same meeting every week. So there are other service opportunities. And so my sponsors made it very clear that I'm not excused from service at all. If I'm in a meeting where the chairs need to be picked up, I pick up the chairs. If they ask for volunteers for something and I don't need to rush off to work or whatever, I need to say yes and do it. In other words, if I'm not committed to be somewhere else by a certain time. And then also just looking for opportunities as they come, you know. I do have to be careful, too, not to say yes to everything and forget that part of the 12-step is practicing these principles in all my affairs, and that my daughters expect a mother, you know, to be around, and my husband expects not to get just my leftovers, you know, but for me to show up and participate in our marriage. So it does help that he's in, for us, it helps that he's in the program. Sometimes that doesn't help that situation, but it does help. We're like-minded, and one of our daughters inspired us. Actually, we do these family meetings every week. We're missing our family meeting tonight, but we'll do it on Monday, where we talk about the schedule and any issues or complaints and the expectations for the kids and who's going to do what chores this week. But my husband and I have our own, too, where we powwow and talk about, you know, what commitments people have asked us to do, what conferences we're planning on going to, and just make sure everybody is on the same page. That this isn't the Barbara show. It's not the Isaac show. A big mistake I made early on with trying to practice these principles and having a family with the kids was making it the Marcella and Rebecca show, you know, because I was going to make up for my feeling insecure as a child by giving my children every freaking thing they asked for. My husband, who's first generation American, was not into that approach at all. He comes from a very different mindset, much more frugal minded, and which is good. We're like yin and yang; we balance each other out. And so, the best thing for people, just like with sponsorship, is not to, you know, always hold the hand or always be the stern voice. There's some place in between where I just need to show up. Be a safe place and speak based on the principles and or my own experience. And sometimes keep my mouth shut, you know, and be a good listener, you know. I feel like talking about working the principles in my life is such a great reminder that sometimes, you know, thank God it's one day at a time, because if I think about all the areas where I could do better on any given day, which I do try to do with the 10 step, but I mean, it could be a little overwhelming. If I'm really looking at myself with that 10 step inventory, I find there's a lot to pray about in the 11 step and a lot of opportunities in the 12 step. The last thing I'll talk about is practicing these principles with finances. You know, talks about in our literature, it says if we are not honest with our creditors, it's like in the 8th and 9th step somewhere in here. I don't want to misquote it. There's something about if we're not honest with our creditors, we are sure to drink again. There's definitely something about finances and being sure to drink again. I know somewhere in my brain I know it, but I worked last night and it fell out of my brain. Yeah. You can find it. It's in here in 8 and 9. I used to just ring up debt. My husband and I keep separate bank accounts and then have joint things for expenses. And so I used to just ring up debt, and then every 6 months or so I would tell him, oh, I need to borrow like $5,000. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, I'm making, you know, doesn't matter, but enough to have paid all for all that stuff. So where did it go, you know? And I kept doing this over and over and over again. And in doing the 8th and 9th step with my sponsor, that section was pointed out to me. I need to live a different way of life in all my affairs. There isn't like, honestly, there really isn't an area I'm aware of in my life that I wouldn't be free to share with you that's appropriate, you know. There, like, I used to be, when I was in the program before my sobriety date, I would get asked to speak places, and I would speak, but there, if you saw me speak and you heard me and I was like all funny or whatever, if you saw the way I actually lived, or you took a look at my bank account, or how much I was still living off my mom while I was working a full-time job out of college, or the way I was, you know, flirting with other men when I, you know, was dating my husband, what I was at the podium not matched the way I was living, which is why I couldn't stay sober. You know, I mean, I really, some of that stuff has just been removed, but the finances was a tricky thing for me. You know, I had a period when I was about 11 years old when my dad left, where we didn't have enough to eat. And it wasn't very long. My mom got trained up on computers. Again, God working in mysterious ways. That was the right move. It was like 1982 or something. Like, who was looking? And she went into it early and ended up doing so well for herself and has retired comfortably. And we went from nothing to, you know, she's got her own place and she's doing great, you know. But that period of insecurity really rattled something in me that never quite wired back together, you know. And so, and being part of my other defects with the pride, it was more about how I looked actually than having money in the bank, because I can go the other way where it's like you just hoard everything, you know. But for me, it was like I had to always look like I had all the money and you know, always pick up the tab and be a big shot. And to be right size in my finances and be honest with my husband was so important, and has really revolutionized our marriage. I mean, isn't that a funny thing? Mm-hmm. I thought it wasn't important because it's not a big deal to me. And honestly, money does not hold the same value for me that it does for him. But recognizing, God, it was like 100,000 miles for me to get to recognizing that because something has value to him and I committed to a marriage to him, that is actually important. It's not just about me and how I think. It was just like, you know, that was like one of those things where a brain cell exploded. And I was like, oh, you know. So those things happen to me sometimes. I'm like, whoa. You know? So, you know, that has opened up for, you know, other areas in the lives of my mom, my life with my brother, all of these relationships where I see not just through my own glasses, but able to see from their perspective and be a better listener, be a better friend, be a better daughter, be a better sister, be a better wife. Always with room to grow. So with that, I feel like, I don't know if it's my higher power or just physically, I'm going to lose my voice any moment. So one of those things is telling me that I have shared enough. So glad to be in a meeting and see other alcoholics, I know, not just on a screen or over the phone, but like actually see you. And I will also say, just for the record, so I do work in healthcare and I work in an emergency department. And not to get into any details, but I am not going to shake anybody's hand, okay, or hug anybody. So that's it. Thanks for letting me share.
I'm Sam. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you so much, Barbara, for